They said it couldn't get more volatile. And then suddenly, brutally, dramatically, it did. The Supreme Leader and many of Iran's top officials were killed this past weekend, victims of American and Israeli bombs. Hezbollah has now formally entered the war, widening the conflict to Lebanon. And while missiles fly across borders, oil tankers are dropping anchor in the Strait of Hormuz, and the world is braced for further violence. It's News Talk Daily Extra. I'm Ciara Doherty, and we are bringing you this bonus episode because over the past 72 hours, the situation in the Middle East has really shifted dramatically. And as you know, joint US-Israeli strikes targeted Iranian nuclear and military and political sites and killed the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. In retaliation, Iran launched waves of missiles towards Israeli and American military facilities across the region. Hezbollah has now entered the conflict in revenge for what it calls the pure blood of the Ayatollah. Israel is responding today with intense strikes on Lebanon and its capital, Beirut. So we're asking, how did diplomacy fail? Does killing a supreme leader actually collapse a regime or potentially harden it? And are we watching escalation without any clear off-ramp? Well, to help us understand this very complicated moment, I'm joined by Dr. Edward Burke, who's Assistant Professor in the History of War at University College Dublin. And you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ed, I think it's fair to say we're in a dramatically different place actually this afternoon, because not only is Iran's supreme leader dead, but Hezbollah now in Lebanon has said that it has entered the war, and strikes within the wider region have widened. We seem to have watched this unfold and escalate extremely quickly.
You certainly have. I mean, I think it's predictable that this would happen. The Supreme Leader, of course, is not only the head of state in Iran, but of course a man who is revered by many within the Shia world in the Middle East. And we've seen, you know, furious responses, reactions in Iraq, but also, of course, in Lebanon and indeed in Pakistan, violence in all those countries. And I think we can certainly see more to come in the following days. And of course, Iran has had, you know, particularly since last June, has had a lot of time to plan for this. Now, that doesn't mean that things are going to be easy for the Iranian military in the conventional sense. They only have limited stockpiles of missiles, armed drones, etc. And eventually in the coming days, it's likely that these will be seriously depleted. But they do have the potential for unconventional responses. Again, using sort of more, potentially acts of terrorism, mobilizing militia in places like Iran. We've already seen Hezbollah enter the fray. So I think we can see, certainly a lot more reaction, a lot more violence and potentially acts of terrorism in the coming days and weeks as well from Iran.
So you see Iran's response as the use of further militias in the region, the further proxies in the regions, and I suppose calling in their intelligence networks.
Yeah, certainly. That's something which I think, you know, Europe as well has to be very conscious of. You know, Iranian intelligence reaches very far across the world, and we've clearly obviously seen acts of terrorism in the past that have had been sponsored by Iran, and they have links to criminal gangs, including, of course, as we know, the Kinahan gang and the major crime cartels. You know, they have particular reach if they want to go down, if they want to sort of use terrorism as a means of response to this wave of attacks by the United States and Israel. Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns here. I think on the other hand, the energy crisis, I mean, essentially what we're seeing now is you know, the stoppage of commercial traffic in the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz. That has major impacts in terms of the, you know, which will lead to an energy crisis, not least for the Asian markets, which depend so heavily on oil and gas from the Gulf region. If that happens, obviously, we'll be moving towards the risk of a global recession. So I think there'll be significant pressure in the coming days on the United States and Iran from regional actors, from regional states, and including from Europe, to try and find an off-ramp here. But whether, of course, you know, events might spiral out of control, again, it just could take an act of terrorism sponsored by Iran, significant casualties on the part of the United States or Israel, or significant civilian casualties in the Gulf. And suddenly, you know, instead of detente, we have further escalation, a further desire for revenge. And then we're in a very, very dangerous position.
As you mentioned there, the economic dimension of this is already visible with tankers being attacked in the region, shipping pauses, aviation disruption ongoing within the Middle East. But why does this economic element, I suppose, matter when it comes to some of the big players in the region like China and India, and how might they respond to this?
Yeah, I mean, they're very dependent on hydrocarbons and imports from the Gulf region. I mean, obviously, the United States essentially doesn't rely in any way on sort of oil and gas from this region. It clearly has invested in that sector, but it does not rely upon it for its own energy security. Asia is completely different, and they are hugely reliant. And of course, as we know, some of the world's, you know, largest proven reserves are in places like Iran and Iraq, and these are strategically vital countries for China and for India particularly. So there will be pressure from both these countries for the United States to take its foot off the accelerator here when it comes to this wave of attacks. We'll see how that plays out. Ultimately, we also have, of course, NATO member state Turkey, who's profoundly affected by this. That will also want to see detente in the region. The energy security element is important. Of course, we know also that, you know, other markets depend on Qatari liquefied natural gas, LNG, not as far afield as Europe, rely upon Qatari LNG. So, and we've seen that ultimately today, Qatar has largely stopped production. So a global energy crisis is going to lead to a global recession. And, you know, we have to wait and see whether Trump, how the conflict unfolds. I mean, obviously, it depends, again, on this trial of strength between the United States, Israel and Iran. If Iran retains the ability to attack the Gulf and the wider Middle East, targets in the wider Middle East, or even into the Mediterranean, as we saw with Cyprus today, then the United States begins to run short of interceptor missiles, for example, then we're into a very uncertain, very even more dangerous situation. So there's a bit of a trial of strength here as to whether the United States and Israel can hurry, can accelerate their campaign to take out Iran's missile launch capabilities. And we'll see if that happens in the next few days. If they fail in the next 72 hours to do that, then we're looking at further escalation and further unpredictability in terms of where this conflict can go, with major ramifications for the global economy.
As you say, drones have reached as far as Cyprus today, an EU member state. Are we, and by we I mean Europe, are we exposed in ways here that perhaps the United States isn't at?
Cyprus is, and of course, a European state, the UK, in terms of its sovereign bases in Cyprus, is also exposed, as we saw today. No, not a fatal attack, but RAF Arkatiri, the RAF base there, are clearly hit by Iranian munition. But I think we're more exposed when it comes to the intelligence capabilities of the Revolutionary Guards of Iran, and that they have these very entangled networks of influence and espionage, and they have proven themselves to be able to carry out assassinations, terrorist attacks in Europe before. So if this conflict keeps on going, then, you know, certainly they can leverage these intelligence resources in Europe to potentially, as I say, carry out attacks in the European continent in a way that they find the United States more difficult to reach. So that is very concerning. And I think, you know, right now, a lot of European states will be ramping up their internal security protection precautions against such an attack. And I would imagine that some are beginning to raise their terrorism alert indicators as well.
You've written before about diplomatic failure in the region, and there had been some hope that the ongoing talks in Oman might lead to some form of a deal. Now, I see Pete Hegseth out this afternoon saying, he's of course the US Secretary of Defense, saying that those negotiations really weren't going anywhere. He said the US wanted a peaceful solution, but Tehran was not negotiating, that they were stalling, that they were buying time to reload their missile stockpiles and restart their nuclear ambitions. Their goal, he said, was to hold us hostage, threatening to strike our forces. Well, President Trump doesn't play those games. Is it your opinion that that's why diplomacy collapsed here?
No, it's not. I mean, I do think that, I mean, it's, again, it depends on who you listen to. Obviously, the Omani government have been, you know, very embarrassed and are quite angry about the way that these intensive talks were suddenly completely jettisoned, destroyed by this wave of attacks on Iran. I think they genuinely felt they were getting somewhere. I think there was some anger in the United States that what was becoming increasingly obvious is that, contrary to what President Trump said last June, that they had not completely obliterated Iran. Capacity to enrich uranium, that the regime retained this capacity to ramp this up in the future. I think that's embarrassing. And that also seems to be the intelligence assessment of in the United States. So that's embarrassing for the Trump administration. There certainly is evidence to say that Iran was, of course, getting ready for an armed campaign. But I think the jettisoning of diplomatic talks, I think, has understandably really angered those who believed that there was a lot of progress was being made in terms of Iran agreeing to quite low levels of enrichment potentially. But it depends on who you listen to, whether you listen to the Omani foreign minister, or you listen to, you know, Pete Hegseth, in terms of how you want to draw your conclusions there. I think ultimately as well, we shouldn't underestimate the intervention of the Israeli government in recent days. Obviously, any sense of detente or, you know, better relations between Iran and the United States with the, you know, a new deal of the century, as Trump might call it, that is something that Israel wants to avoid at all costs. And so in that sense, the Israeli government have been successful. I think as well that this is, you know, Israel, this is also part of an intelligence opportunity, that basically that the Israelis and the United States recognized that they had an opportunity, a very perhaps unique opportunity, to decapitate much of the Iranian leadership by launching these strikes on Saturday, based on the intelligence that they had, based because they knew that there would be an important meeting taking place of Iranian security officials. So they had really excellent intelligence that lended itself to this attack on Saturday. And they decided, rather than sort of listening to the voices of optimism and diplomacy in Oman and indeed in other capitals in the Gulf, that they would go ahead and launch a strike.
But ultimately, what you are saying there is that you feel that Israel didn't want this negotiated deal between the US and Iran, and they wouldn't have been satisfied with the idea that Iran was allowed to continue on in any capacity in building its nuclear arsenal.
Absolutely. The Israelis are committed to regime change, not detente with the regime. And we've seen that in terms of the Israelis are particularly focused on their strikes on internal security forces, the besieged, this kind of revolutionary militia, you know, law enforcement council that they have there, the kind of police, you know, basically the bodies that have been, you know, at the forefront of brutally and ruthlessly clamping down on and killing thousands of Iranians in protests last month. That's what they've been really targeting, those forces, which had nothing to do with, you know, Iran's ability to project armed force externally. So that in itself is telling that, you know, that the Israelis do very much want regime change, and they are, you know, my view, it's a very risky, in some ways that's quite risky in terms of what might come, what we know from previous decapitations, regime change operations in the Middle East in the past, that this can have risk. But that's what Israel is committed to. I think some of the United States were interested for a time as to whether a sort of a major diplomatic breakthrough, such as unprecedented lowering of enrichment targets, or even a scrapping of Iran's nuclear program entirely, that would be enough of a win for Trump to celebrate, far better, let's say, than the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action that President Obama negotiated over Iran's nuclear program. And for Trump to outdo that would be enough. I think some people in the State Department in the United States were interested in that. But what happened here is that voices from the Israeli government, I think, really reached out to Washington. We know that Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke a lot to President Trump about Iran recently. And that ultimately, I think some of those voices were quite persuasive to Trump that he had a unique opportunity. And of course, he's on, you know, since what happened in January in Venezuela, he's on an interventionist high here. He's on a bit of a sugar high in terms of, you know, using military force and seeing that there's very few repercussions for the United States, then actually some benefits for the US. So I think he was trying to repeat that trick here. Iran is not Venezuela. This is going to be much, much more complicated and is much, much more dangerous. So we're looking at a very high risk gamble here by the United States and Israel.
And I suppose it is worth pointing out, there are others who would say that Israel and United States just calculated that the regime in Iran was extremely vulnerable at this time, that they were dealing with a severe economic crisis, continuing to deal with the fallout from that brutal crackdown on the protesters that we saw in January of this year, and their defences were still really badly damaged by that short-lived war last summer. And between all of that and this newfound intelligence on the Ayatollah's whereabouts, that this was just a big opportunity not to be squandered. But it's interesting to hear that you're coming at it from a slightly different perspective. But to go, I suppose, to what they feel they have achieved here, which I think is so interesting in Iran, and why Iran perhaps is very different to Iraq or Libya or indeed Venezuela, the most recent example, is that you are dealing with a different structure here, aren't you? Completely. Like, this was not a one-man band. This was not a one-man show. The setup within Iran is completely different, which is why I think perhaps removing the Ayatollah and killing the Ayatollah is not going to have the consequences that perhaps the United States are predicting.
Absolutely not. So this is a regime that sort of, you know, obviously, in some ways, the decapitation of the supreme leader is not going to solve the, you know, in terms of command and control of the military and capabilities, you know, the supreme leader and indeed the leadership had planned for this. And also, when it came to a lot of the operational detail, they were not involved in much of it. So there are many, many conservative, you know, Shia Muslims who are, you know, genuinely outraged at what about what has happened. And this man has influenced beyond his own borders. And we've seen that in terms of the response from people like Ayatollah Ali Sistani in Iraq and other Shia religious leaders around the world. So they are genuinely outraged. And so in some ways, that enraging people across the region who would look upon the, I mean, we obviously see the regime in Europe, particularly as for, you know, in terms of its brutal record, its repression, atrocities, torture, etc. But of course, there are many people who don't see it that way in the Middle East, are see it in a more complicated way in terms of this was still an elevated, you know, senior cleric in Shia Islam, and that was important. And it is important. But the other thing is, of course, that there are different pillars of this regime that have planned for decapitation, are sort of, you know, we've seen the attrition of senior military and intelligence leaders in Iran before. And so they have put in place some plans to ultimately to autonomize some of their capabilities, to, you know, make the regime's ability to resist more regional. The Revolutionary Guards has many layers to it. And of course, as well as having conventional means of response, they also have unconventional means of response. And of course, they are sponsored, you know, very large-scale, powerful militia, and not least in countries such as Iraq, with the Islamic Resistance Forces there, and the popular the popular mobilization forces. And these are, you know, capable, willing to use extreme violence, terrorism. So I think that you're looking at a much more layered regime rather than a sort of pyramidal structure top down, which makes it decapitation difficult. Also, they've invested huge amounts of resources in terms of increasing their internal security. And we've seen that in terms of there is obviously large-scale opposition to the regime, but they are able, through the use of atrocity, through the use of violence, through the use of intelligence, they are able to persistently suppress internal dissent. And the regime remains very, very strong as of today. So, yes, are they militarily vulnerable? Absolutely. Are they militarily, has there been much attrition here in terms of, you know, in terms of their ability to conventionally respond? Yes. On the other hand, what really is the unknowable here is, have they done enough preparations to keep the missile response, to what we've seen in terms of the strain that they can put on, let's say, the wider economy of the Middle East, but also also globally, is that can they maintain the ability to keep resisting in terms of firing these missiles that we've seen over the last 72 hours. If they can do that for another few days, and if the United States and Israel, you know, they have a finite stockpile of interceptor missiles, for example, and the ability to defend their allies. I mean, Iran is hitting out very broadly here. Ultimately, if they cannot reduce the Iranian capacity almost down to, you know, to whereby they can't continue this widespread campaign of missile launches, then, you know, then the United States is in a difficult position in terms of explaining to its allies why, you know, what the future is, what the plan, how the plan can evolve and to cope with this threat. And of course, we have this where they are much stronger is if they wish to use these unconventional forces to carry out things like terrorist attacks across the region or beyond.
And again, it's interesting to look at what Pete Hegseth was saying a little earlier. The current conflict is not a so-called regime change war, but the regime sure did change. So it's, I think, uncertain as to what they really thought the objective was here, what they thought they were going to achieve. I don't think they've that quite worked out yet. Drawing on your knowledge of both history and the region, Ed, what are the plausible endgames here? I mean, where do you see this going? Is a regime collapse, a prolonged, ugly regional war, some sort of forced negotiation?
I think there will be a strong desire, you know, from Gulf countries such as Kuwait. I think arguably the UAE, I think Qatar will be trying to sort of find a way to dial this down now. You know, there is a real potential here for Shia militia to mobilize even beyond Iran and for things to take a much uglier turn. And there is a lot of outrage and a lot of anger in the region about what the United States and Israel are doing. So I think there'll be a real appetite to mediate here. I mean, the problem is that, of course, when Qatar was trying to mediate with Hamas, of course, Israel carried out an attack on which directly targeted mediators. Oman has been humiliated here in terms of trying to offer its good offices in mediation between Iran and the United States. So it is difficult to mediate with an administration as chaotic and as capricious as the Trump administration. But I think there will be interest among some in the Gulf to do so. And I believe also there will be, you know, there is constant dialogue taking place with the Iranian regime through various channels. So the question is, will events simply overtake those attempts at mediation? Again, it just takes one missile to veer off course, large-scale casualties, or indeed a successful attack on a U.S. base or on Israel, which leads to very large-scale casualties, civilian, military, and suddenly, you know, dialogue is shut down and things just ramp up again. So I know indeed that there is a flurry of diplomacy taking place, including from Gulf states, to try and quickly get this dialed down. It's a race against time. This is not well thought out in terms of, I think we can say that, the US government has not explained what its end game is here. What does it want? If it wants regime change, if it believes, as Pete Hegseth seems to think, that they have already engaged in regime change in Tehran, simply, you know, killing an octogenarian cleric who had less and less control over the military, intelligence and security forces in the state and indeed divested much of this control, it's very symbolic. But does it actually change who's in control? The Islamic Republic still exists. There are other senior clerics who are even more extreme than Khamenei himself, who've been advocating a much more aggressive response to the United States. So actually, it was the Supreme Leader who was the one, for all his, you know, his brutal policies of extreme violence and atrocities against protesters, etc., was the one advocating for a detente last year after the June strikes carried out by Israel and the United States. So we may be looking at a more extreme regime in the coming days unless these urgent diplomatic contacts have some success.
All right, Dr. Edward Burke from UCD, thank you so much for joining us for this News Talk Daily Extra.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, this really is one of those moments where history feels like it's accelerating in real time, and what happens next will depend on calculations, or indeed, as Ed says, miscalculations that are being made in Tehran and Jerusalem and Washington and capitals right across the region. Whether it is a short and brutal phase of confrontation or something much longer and more destabilizing is still really, really unclear. It is worth pointing out for now that the Irish troops that are serving with UNIFIL in Lebanon are safe and are accounted for, while the Department of Foreign Affairs is advising Irish citizens in the Gulf to shelter in place. And we'll continue to follow developments very closely here on News Talk Daily. That's it for News Talk Daily Extra. Our regular podcast will follow tomorrow, as always. Thanks for listening.